The following is a recording of Resurgent Russia in the Time of Trump, a special event hosted by Aspen Public Radio at Pepke Auditorium on August 22, 2017. Corey Flintoff, former NPR bureau chief in Moscow, was joined on stage by Tom Korologos, former U.S. ambassador to Belgium. Flintoff reported for NPR as Russian President Vladimir Putin cracked down on dissent, seized Crimea, and led Russia into war in eastern Ukraine. Since his recent return to the U.S., Flintoff has been following the revelations of the Trump administration's ties to Russia and what that could mean for the future of relations between two of the world's most potently armed nations. The event was sponsored in part by iFolios at Ryan Investments. APR Executive Director Carolyn Heldman introduced Flintoff and Korologos.
The last time we were in this auditorium, one of the guests sat on their microphone, so we couldn't hear him for the first 30 seconds or so. It was pretty funny. Don't sit on your microphone, gentlemen. Do you know where your microphone's at? Good evening, everybody. I'm Carolyn Heldman. I'm the executive director at Aspen Public Radio. Very happy to have you all here. You represent record attendance for us at an event, so we're very appreciative of you being here and not at the National Orthopedic Surgeons Conference, which is also happening tonight. I know that's a big draw. So thank you for choosing this instead. We also have a lot of people here who are not members of Aspen Public Radio, which means that they might be new to Aspen Public Radio. So we are very welcoming to you all. So happy that you're here, and we'd like to invite you to check us out. We are low on the dial, down in the 90s usually at any major city. You can find it in the 80s, 90s, somewhere in there. And I think being here, you will hopefully see that we provide you with trusted, balanced, accurate news, which is in short supply these days. One little quick plug that Fast Company, which ranks 25 most trusted brands every year, just came out with their new list of the 25 most trusted brands in America, and NPR this year is number 10. I know, it's huge. It's the only media company on the list, so we're very pleased to be part of that. Loyal listeners, thank you so much for being here. National Council's here. A lot of our board is here as well. Our board chair is here. So say hello. Those of you who are coming to our cocktail reception, that part is also sold out. So if you didn't get a ticket, I'm sorry for that. But those of you who do have tickets to the reception, which is hosted by Ryan Investments, you'll head out to these doors here. We were going to have it in Meyer, but now we're going to have it in Coke. And it'll be covered, and we'll have a nice evening there. So head over there after. We will turn this over to audience Q&A, time permitting. We will have mic runners, so make sure you are speaking in a mic if you have a question. We are going to record this, and we'll have it on our website later for those of you who want to hear again. Let me introduce tonight's guests. Our topic tonight is Resurgent Russia in the Time of Trump. Our guest interviewer this evening is Aspen Public Radio board member Tom Korologos. Mr. Korologos started his career as a reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune and the Associated Press. He served in the Nixon and Ford administrations and worked closely with Presidents Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and George W. Bush. He's currently a strategic advisor at DLA Piper in Washington, D.C. Our special guest, Corey Flintoff, has been a radio journalist for almost 40 years. He got his start at the Alaska Public Radio Network before joining NPR in 1990 as a newscaster. In 2001, bored being just reading the news, he asked for an assignment to go out in the field as a foreign correspondent heading first to Iraq. As a reporter for NPR, Flintoff covered the wars in Afghanistan and Ukraine, the revolution in Egypt, and civil war in Libya. Most recently, he was the bureau chief in Moscow. Please join me in welcoming Tom Korologos and Corey Flintoff.
Let me add my welcome to Corey and all the rest of you here at our Aspen Public Radio event. Corey, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm really happy to be here.
Let me begin with a threshold question here. 2 weeks ago or three, we had the Aspen Security Forum, and all the brilliant NSA, CIA, everybody agreed that there was interference in the U.S. elections by the Russians. We all know the intervention in Ukraine. Congress passes sanction bills in the House, passed 419-3, and in the Senate, 98-2. Tit for tat diplomatic relations, they take this away, we take that away. Unarmed Russian planes flying over the CIA and Pentagon. Let me read you a couple of headlines. This is just one page out of the New York Times, July 31st. Putin hopes for relief under a Trump presidency backfires spectacularly. In parade, Russia puts ambitions on display. U.S. must cut diplomatic staff in Russia by 755, Putin says. And this morning, you pick up the paper, Russia names a hardline ambassador to Washington, and U.S. sharply curbs visas. We have Russia involved in Syria, and this is only August. Is the Cold War back?
You know, if you'd asked me that question even a year ago, I would have said no. I would have said, yeah, we're very close. I mean, things have deteriorated enormously. But I would not have actually said that we were in a new Cold War. Yes, today we are. And I think, you know, the examples you cited show that basically Putin has given up on the Trump administration as a way for him to lift sanctions and sort of restore some measure of relations between the United States and Russia. The decision to throw so many employees out of the U.S. embassy in Moscow was an enormous overreaction to the Obama administration's decision to dismiss, what was it, 35 or so Russian diplomats. You know, and as a matter of fact, of those 750 who were dismissed, I think some 500 of them are actually Russians. So there's that. There's the decision to basically slap the United States State Department in the face by sending this new ambassador, Anatoly Antonov, who's a very strong hardliner in the Kremlin and in the Russian diplomatic service, a man who is under U.S. sanctions because of his role in the seizure of Crimea. They could hardly have picked a more offensive choice as Russian ambassador. And, you know, as a former ambassador yourself, you know how important that sort of thing is. I don't see how the United States can accept this man's credentials.
I'm not sure how quickly they're going to give him our grandmother to enter the country.
Yeah.
But that could be another tat for the last tip.
Exactly.
That didn't sound right, did it? Did Putin bet on Trump and lose his shirt? Tell us about him. Is there any? I met him once when I was in Belgium. He's about as cold a fish as you ever want to see. Reports are that he has squirreled away $200 billion. Compare that with Gates, who has $84 billion, Warren Buffett, $60 billion, Bloomberg, $48 billion, thanks to Google. Did he bet on Trump? Is there envy? How much Trump is there in Putin?
Let's start with the first of those questions. You know, before I left Moscow, I did quite a few stories about the Russian reaction to the Trump candidacy. And some of the analysts and Kremlin-connected people that I talked to were almost giddy. because they believed that a Trump presidency would be a win-win for them one way or another. Either Trump would actually improve relationships with the Putin regime and work towards dropping U.S. and European sanctions on Russia, or he would create such turmoil in the United States that Russia, that the United States would no longer have its focus on foreign policy around the world and would leave Russia a much freer hand. So, I mean, you can take your choice as to what happened. So I think that he did make a big bet on Trump. I think there are elements of Trump that he admired. And one of the things he admired is the showmanship that Trump displayed during his campaign. Putin is a good friend of Berlusconi from Italy. And there's another guy, you know, who obtained his leadership in Italy on the basis of showmanship and almost nothing else. You know, but still managed to strut on the stage as a world leader and did it largely through the power of his own personal charisma. Putin is a guy who, as you say, is a cold fish. He came to power as a technocrat, a guy who had worked in the municipal administration in St. Petersburg, former KGB lieutenant colonel, as we know. And he didn't, if you look at him, at video of him when he first came to power, he didn't have a lot of charisma. He is a man who has taught himself to take over the stage and be a charismatic leader. And I've seen him quite a number of times in person in stage performances like this, and he is the guy who no one can take their eyes off of. And he's made himself into that. He's not a very large man. We know he's like around 5, he says 5'7", we're thinking 5'5". But he managed to occupy a tremendous amount of space on a stage. He manspreads. He throws his arm over the back of his chair. He fills up as much physical space as he possibly can. So I can perfectly understand why he would admire somebody to whom showmanship came as a natural thing.
Have you seen him with his shirt off?
Never in person, thankfully.
Tell me about his, is there such a thing as a Russian poll? Like we have a popularity poll, a negative, a positive. The Russians like him?
Yes, his poll numbers always hover at around about 83%. You know, what leader in the West wouldn't give his eye teeth for numbers like that? And it's not, I mean, some of those numbers are inflated. The state-run polling agencies are probably not very accurate. But, real independent surveys show that he has an enormous amount of support among the Russian people. And one of the reasons for that is that he controls the Russian media absolutely. 93% of Russians get their news from television. There are a number of state-run television channels that are devoted solely to the glory of Putin. There are a number of nominally independent television channels that are owned by oligarchs who are part of Putin's circle. So they're projecting the same message. And they show him as a strong, effective leader, you know, who is always working in Russia's best interest. And it's pretty hard to overcome that.
How real are some of these insurgent demonstrations and what you see in the streets once in a while, from time to time? Is that serious, or do they let them have their say and then they go home? What happens after that?
You know, that's another question. If you had asked me a couple of years ago, I would have said that the opposition is dead in Russia. When I first got there, it was in 2012, so it was when there were these massive street demonstrations in Moscow and St. Petersburg. Hundreds of thousands of people turned out, middle-class people, sort of the intellectual class in Russia. And they very bravely came out for two reasons. One is that they were fed up with what they regarded as a completely fraudulent parliamentary election that put Russia's, that Putin's ruling party in power. And secondly, Putin's decision to come back to the presidency, you know, it was a really arrogant gesture, and a lot of people deeply resented it. So they came out and they protested really impressively. I saw people out in the dead of winter, absolute freezing cold, standing for hours and hours just to protest Putin. That was before the election. After the election that brought Putin back to the presidency, the repression started, and it was very effective. They were arresting protesters and giving them unbelievably harsh sentences. You know, for participating in a protest, you could be subject to as much as 4 years in a Russian prison. So that dampened the enthusiasm quite a lot. There was constant harassment of opposition groups, or even groups that tended to reveal fraud on the part of the Russian government. There was a repression of civil rights groups and civil society organizations. They shut down Golos, which was the Russian election monitoring group that revealed so much of the corruption in the election that people were so angry about. And so little by little, they managed to shut down the opposition. My wife and I went to protests whenever they happened, and they'd happen every 6 months or so. And we saw the number of people who turned out diminishing by the year. You know, it started out as 15,000, then it went to 10,000, then it went to 5,000, until finally I started recognizing a lot of people who were there. And the truly awful thing about it is that they were my age. So I really thought that the opposition movement in Russia was dead until this summer. You remember in June, there was a colossal demonstration. Demonstrations throughout Russia, because they happened in more than 100 Russian cities. The turnout in Moscow and St. Petersburg was absolutely huge. And they were attended largely by young people, and they were largely angry about corruption in the Russian government. So my head has been turned around on this thing, and I think that there is a potential for a real Russian opposition to rise again.
First of all, Corey's wife, Mary, is in the audience. Stand up, Mary, and say hello.
Yes. There she is.
Thank you. You just ran down a list of a lot of things going on, insurgency. As a reporter, NPR, how do you cover insurgents? How do you cover, well, the murders of Putin political opponents, the athletic doping scandal, both at Sochi and elsewhere? Are there press conferences? Did you have sources? How do you cover Russia and all these things you just listed?
You do a great deal of it through sources. One thing that foreign correspondents still have in Russia is a lot of freedom of movement around the country. So nobody is stopping me from going out to Kazan or Vladivostok or Sochi to cover a story there. Nobody is preventing me from talking to people on the streets or even from going to the offices of NGOs or opposition leaders and talking to them. You get no help whatever from the government. I used to put in request after request for people from the Russian ministries to talk to me about the most mundane kinds of things. You know, all I wanted really was some government response to this or that, you know, economic story or political story or whatever. And I quickly discovered that no one had any serious interest in talking to me. They'll never tell you that, of course. They'll tell you, well, we need to go back to our boss, and we need to see how the schedule looks, and we'll get back to you. They never do. And you keep calling, and you keep calling, and they get you right up to the time when they know you'll be on deadline, and they tell you, I'm sorry, it's just not possible. So, in fact, you get no cooperation from Russian government officials, and I finally, shortly before I left, I got a straight answer from an official who had refused my interview. And he said, look, what's the point of me doing an interview with you, a foreign reporter? I can only lose by it, because either I will say something wrong that will get me in trouble, or you'll misquote me in some way and get me into trouble. So there's no upside of this for me. So a lot of what you do is done with people on the street, people from NGOs that still exist in Russia, and analysts, independent analysts.
Were you bugged? Did they follow you? Were you nervous? Were you?
My Russian coworkers, and I had two of them, a business manager and a Russian producer, who worked in my office, were convinced that we were bugged. We all lived in a building that had been set aside for diplomats and journalists ever since Soviet times. And so there was no doubt in their minds. And in fact, when we used to discuss salary issues, they insisted that we go outside because they didn't want the Russian tax authorities to know what they were really making. So, yes. And in fact, most Russians will tell you, well, of course the authorities have the ability to bug you. The question is, you know, do they have the capacity to really listen to what you're saying?
Did they care?
And did they care? That's another thing. That bought me a lot of space in Russia because, frankly, you know, the Russian authorities are very familiar with the New York Times and with the BBC, but they're not terribly familiar with NPR. And so I got the latitude to move around Russia quite a lot, almost anonymously, without them paying any attention to me.
Take us during the Malaysian plane shoot down. You covered that, and it was quite remarkable, the job you did on that. Tell us a little bit of story about that, and what's new in that? Anything new? What's happening?
There's always something new on the Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 story, and that's because the investigations are still ongoing. The Dutch, particularly, their safety board has an investigation that reports periodically. The conclusion that they're going to have to come to is that Russians shot down that passenger airplane, killing 298 people, that it was a Russian crew using a Russian missile that had been brought across the border from Russia into Ukraine and was located on the so-called separatist territory when it fired the missile. I personally, from everything I've done, and I talked to a lot of people in eastern Ukraine about this, my personal opinion is that it was an accident. I think this Russian missile crew saw a plane flying overhead and mistook it for a Ukrainian transport plane. They'd already successfully shot down a couple of Ukrainian fighter jets, and they were quite full of themselves about it. And so they fired at this thing. And then there are sort of heartrending moments when the so-called separatists get to the crash scene and see that it's a civilian airplane with children and children's toys and bodies scattered all over the place. So I think they were clearly surprised. But, you know, I think it shows something about the cynicism and the duplicity of the Putin regime that from the very beginning they lied about this thing. They tried to pin it on the Ukrainian Air Force. They tried to say that there was a bomb aboard. Some Russian officials actually said that it was an airliner that had been loaded with corpses in the Netherlands and flown over this territory and deliberately destroyed to embarrass the separatists. Things are as far-fetched as that. The real problem for the Russians, for Putin, was that he could not admit that there were Russian soldiers in eastern Ukraine. Well, I mean, I know from my own reporting, from my seeing it with my own eyes, I know that there were Russian military forces in Ukraine from the very beginning, that it's not a separatist conflict or a civil war. It is an invasion of Ukraine by the Russian military.
Did you cover the Georgia-Estonia incursions before then? Did you cover when they went into Georgia?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it started out slowly, and the Russian effort in eastern Ukraine started out slowly and came very close to failure. They used thugs in various cities of Ukraine to try to create revolution and conflict. For instance, in Odessa, there was almost a kind of civil war that took place in the streets, designed to overthrow the Ukrainian government. It failed because most people in Odessa, and Odessa is an overwhelmingly ethnic Russian city, didn't want it. It almost failed in places like Donetsk, which is the major city of eastern Ukraine, except that, because people, and I was there, they laughed at these so-called separatists. I mean, a lot of them were clearly thugs right out of prison because they had all their Russian prison tattoos. You'd go to places where they occupied buildings and you'd see what kind of people they were. And that almost failed because the people of eastern Ukraine rejected this. And the Russians had to send in increasingly sophisticated groups of Secret Service officers and former Russian military officers and money and weapons to make sure that this thing actually succeeded. So there's no question in my mind it's a Russian invasion.
Tell us about religions in Russia. The Russian Orthodox Church, even Stalin didn't take them on. The Mormons, the Catholics, Jehovah's Witnesses. Radio Free Europe has said that Jewish community is moving to Israel in droves. Tell us about the religious issues going on there.
Well, the Russian Orthodox Church is predominant. 93% of the Russian population identifies as Russian Orthodox Church adherents, although supposedly only about 3 to 5% of them actually go to church. One thing you'll notice, though, about almost every Russian who doesn't wear a Star of David has a Russian Orthodox crucifix. So it's a cultural thing, basically. The Russian Orthodox Church is tremendously powerful, and it's very closely allied with the Putin regime. The current patriarch of the Orthodox Church, Kirill, is a former KGB agent. He's a guy who, in the run-up to the election that brought Putin back to the presidency, described Vladimir Putin as a miracle from God. So the very top hierarchy of the Russian Orthodox Church is very much in the corner of the Kremlin. I mean, they're very much part of that. As a result, they reap a lot of money. They had, I don't know if this is still true, but they had a corner on the cigarette market in Moscow. They received a tax on cigarettes that were sold. And as you probably know, Russians are very heavy smokers, so it made them a lot of money. As to other religions, though, the situation is deteriorating markedly. You know, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, churches like the Mormons and the Jehovah's Witnesses gained a lot of ground in Moscow, and various evangelical churches did as well. They have been very significantly repressed throughout Russia, and I did a story about the Jehovah's Witnesses who were singled out and no longer allowed to proselytize. You know, laws would be tailored in such a way to make sure that only Jehovah's Witnesses were affected. So, in fact, you cannot conduct door-to-door missionary work or hold services in people's homes. So that essentially shut down their work. They're like the Russian Orthodox Church, the Jewish community in Russia, the very top of the hierarchy is associated with the government and supportive of the government. But there's been a widespread return to Orthodox Judaism, and I did some stories on that as well. People had to virtually sort of reinvent their culture or rediscover their culture, but they were doing it quite successfully in Moscow when I was there, And there were congregations reforming, you know, all over the city and in many, many other cities in Russia. That has stopped, and it's not so much because of official repression as in the case of the Mormons, but it's because of a fear of the return of the kind of repression that people suffered during Soviet times. You know, so I think that people who remained in Russia after so many Jews emigrated are hedging their bets now. They know what happened in the past. They're not taking any chances. They're, for instance, obtaining Israeli citizenship.